Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member, FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 14th of January, these are our main stories. France and five West African countries have agreed to combine their forces in the Sahel to fight a growing Islamist insurgency. Queen Elizabeth says she supports the desire of Prince Harry and Meghan to live a more independent life, and they have made clear they do not want to be reliant on public funds. And the nominations for this year's Oscars have been announced, with the dark comic book movie Joker up for 11 Academy Awards. Also in this podcast:
for our future missions to the Moon and Mars, we're focusing on sustainability, how we can improve our understanding of crop growth.
The tree saplings grown from seeds that have been to space are now being planted back here on Earth. 90 soldiers from Niger killed in an Islamist attack last week. 13 French troops who died in a helicopter crash in Mali in November. Just some of the thousands of deaths in the Sahel region in West Africa, which has become a front line in the war against Islamist and separatist insurgency. The presidents of five West African countries, Chad, Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso and Mauritania, have ended their summit in southwestern France by pledging to combat the growing threat from jihadist networks. Thousands of French soldiers are deployed in the region. The summit was hosted by President Macron.
Already strengthened by our convergence with regional leaders, I have decided to commit additional combat capabilities. 220 soldiers will be added to the troops already present on the ground.
The African leaders also called on France to continue its military support. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross told us about the surge in violence.
There have been recent attacks that have killed a lot of soldiers, and the worry for all of these countries in the Sahel and beyond, really, is that despite the presence of thousands of peacekeepers in Mali and the more than 4,000 French troops in the Sahel and all of these countries supposed to be working together in this G5 alliance, these attacks are happening incredibly frequently. You mentioned the 90 or so that were killed last week in Niger. That was the worst ever attack in the country's history, but it was only a month after the previous record when 71 soldiers were killed. In neighbouring Mali, 43 soldiers were killed in one attack in November, 49 in another attack at the beginning of that month. I could go on and on. These are not small-scale attacks. These are really disastrous days for each country when these attacks happen, and what it's led to is more and more protests and unease, especially in Mali, and criticism of the French troop presence and saying, what on earth are the French troops doing here? Our former colonial ruler back in the country when the situation's getting worse. And that's why this summit's going on.
And there are numerous reasons for the increased bloodshed, aren't there?
There are quite a lot of reasons. I mean, you have to look back to when the jihadist violence spread out of Mali after the French troops had gone into 2013 and helped push them out. They basically regrouped and then spread their area of attack and completely ignoring countries' borders. And they've really focused on this area of the Sahel where there isn't very strong governance from the capital cities, and they've long been neglected, these communities, and there are a lot of deep-seated grievances. And it's not just the jihadist attacks. In Mali and in Burkina Faso and Niger, there are also other groups that have come up that are taking advantage of the situation, and they're also adding to the violence. So it is a very bad situation. But the jihadists are highly mobile. They're not seizing territory, but they're carrying out these hit-and-run attacks and especially targeting the military at the moment, which is obviously really, really hurting the countries and causing a lot of anger in all of these countries in the Sahel.
Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross. 21 Saudi Arabian cadets on military training courses in the United States are being expelled as part of the FBI investigation into the fatal shooting of three American servicemen by a Saudi Air Force pilot in December. Here's Ben Wright.
The shooting at Pensacola Naval Base on December the 6th prompted an immediate pause in the training of all Saudi servicemen in the United States and an intensive FBI investigation. At a news conference, the U.S. Attorney General William Barr said Mohammed al-Shamrani acted alone and there was no evidence other Saudi trainees had any advance knowledge of the attack. However, Mr. Barr said 21 Saudi military students were found to have possessed either some jihadist material, child pornography or both.
That was Ben Wright. What now for Prince Harry and his wife Meghan? After hastily convened talks at the Royal Sandringham Estate in eastern England, Queen Elizabeth issued a statement saying that the royal household is taking the first steps towards granting the Duke and Duchess of Sussex their wish to step back from frontline duties. This is how the statement reads.
My family and I are entirely supportive of Harry and Meghan's desire to create a new life as a young family. Although we would have preferred them to remain full-time working members of the royal family, we respect and understand their wish to live a more independent life as a family while remaining a valued part of my family. Harry and Meghan have made clear that they do not want to be reliant on public funds in their new lives.
That was some of the Queen's statement voiced by one of our producers. Well, final details still remain to be ironed out. Our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond, reports from outside the Sandringham estate.
Following a meeting without precedent, a statement from the Queen that is remarkably informal and surprisingly candid. The Queen's statement refers to a period of transition in which the Sussexes will spend time in Canada and the UK. A deal between the palace and the Sussexes is not done yet. The Queen says there's more work to be done, but that she has asked for final decisions to be reached in the coming days. Royal historian Robert Lacey was struck by the personal tone employed by the Queen.
I can't recall a statement from Buckingham Palace with so many, my family, my grandson, my family and I have asked for decisions to be made in the coming days. It's remarkably hands-on.
The Queen says that Harry and Meghan have said they do not wish to be reliant on public funds in their new lives. But otherwise, detail is thin and many questions remain about the relationship between the palace and the couple, about what royal role Harry and Meghan will take, about how they intend to support themselves. Earlier in the day, William and Harry issued a blunt denial of a report in the Times newspaper that Harry was bullied by his older brother and that this had contributed to the split. It was a false story, they said, whose inflammatory language was offensive and potentially harmful. The frenzied speculation that has surrounded the royal family for 5 days now is one of the reasons the Queen wishes to settle this quickly. But the reference to a period of transition when the couple divide their time between the UK and Canada suggests that this change in role is a process rather than an event, that whatever decisions are reached over the next few days may well be up for review in the coming months and years.
That was our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond. So how do other European royal houses strike a balance? Some, such as the Dutch, already have more informal arrangements for their members. Mike Sanders is our Europe editor, and I asked him if the half-in, half-out approach works in other royal courts.
Well, some of them do kind of manage it. Well, you talk about the Dutch, King Willem Alexander of the Netherlands. He came to the throne in 2013, and he revealed, much to the astonishment of the public, that he had for the past 21 years been acting as a flying as a first officer on the national airline KLM, and occasionally even addressed the passengers, you know, fasten your seatbelts and all that kind of thing, and didn't actually say what his real identity was. And he also managed to run the New York City Marathon under the pseudonym W.A. van Buren, which is one of his minor titles. So, yeah, it's worked out well for him. Queen Margrethe of Denmark is probably the shining example of how you can have a private life and still be a queen. She is a very talented illustrator. She illustrated the Dutch edition of J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, and I would absolutely recommend that you look on Google to look at her drawings, which are very impressive indeed. And she's also a talented translator.
So those are some of the shining examples. What about where it doesn't really work?
Well, you have Princess Martha Louise of Norway. Now, she gave up her Royal Highness title, which means she doesn't have any royal duties. She did that in 2002. She got divorced in 2016, and no problem up to that point. But more recently, she's been going out with a man from Los Angeles, who Derek Verrett, who describes himself as a shaman, and she's very interested in the spiritual life. And she's been criticised for promoting events that they do together, spiritual events, as the princess and the shaman. So it's seen as a bit cashing in on her royal status, if not her royal title. I have to add the caveat there that Derek Verrett is a black guy, and he's complained that he's been subjected to terrible racism simply because he's dating a Norwegian princess.
That was our Europe editor, Mike Sanders. Saplings linked to the tree that famously inspired the great scientist Sir Isaac Newton 240 years ago have been distributed around the UK. Not, though, before they, or at least the seeds they were grown from, went on a journey into space. Terry Egan reports.
The great English scientist Sir Isaac Newton has famously been depicted coming up with the theory of gravity after an apple fell on his head. Whatever the truth of that, seeds from the tree which inspired him to think about the laws of motion and gravity have spent 6 months in space. They were taken aboard the International Space Station with the astronaut Tim Peake, all part of a project to find out how they would fare in such a punishing environment. Back on Earth, they've been nurtured in cold storage, and now saplings grown from them have been presented to establishments around the UK. One of the saplings went to Grantham in eastern England, where Sir Isaac was born and developed his theory. Tim Peake was there, and he explains how the aim was also to further future exploration.
For our future missions to the Moon and Mars, we're focusing on sustainability. We need to be able to grow our own food. But more than that, we're actually looking at how we can improve the techniques back on Earth, how we can improve our understanding of crop growth.
Tim's mission into space was called Principia, after Newton's work, and it's hoped the saplings will inspire a future generation of engineers and scientists, taking the science we're now familiar with into realms we still know little about.
That was Terry Egan. Still to come in this podcast.
25% of all Windows users are still running Windows 7, which is a very large percentage.
From today, Microsoft will stop offering support for customers still running Windows 7. A BBC News Arabic investigation has uncovered compelling evidence suggesting that a Syrian Kurdish political leader was killed by a faction of the Turkish-backed Syrian National Army. Hevrin Khalaf was killed in October 2019. The faction, Ahrar al-Sharqiyya, says it's not responsible for her death. But as Simon Cox reports, the evidence tells a different story.
Hevrin Khalaf was a young Syrian Kurdish political leader.
Like we resisted terrorism, like we resisted tyranny, like we resisted oppression, we will resist occupation.
Admired by her local community and respected internationally as someone striving for peace in the region, she was also a vocal opponent to the Turkish operation against the Kurds in northeastern Syria. A Syrian rebel faction, backed by Turkey, was accused of killing her, but denied it. But we've uncovered evidence suggesting this faction had crossed the border from Turkey and executed her.
I lost a sister, a comrade, and also a leader for me and my comrades at work.
Nubahar Mustafa and Hevrin Khalaf were old friends. They worked together at the Future Syria Party, where Hevrin was the Secretary General.
We lost a woman who was working on empowering women, who worked on achieving unity and peace.
On the morning of October 12th, Hevrin Khalaf set off along the main M4 motorway to her party headquarters in Raqqa. Fighters from Akhra al-Shakir, a faction of the Turkish-backed Syrian National Army, were on the motorway too. The video posted by fighters show them arriving at the motorway shortly after sunrise, between 6:30 and 7 a.m. Eyewitnesses said they'd crossed over from Turkey hours earlier. They began stopping cars at a checkpoint and then asking other fighters to film them killing people on the road. By identifying features in the background of the videos and comparing them with a satellite image of the area, we located them to a checkpoint called Tilwazir, the same checkpoint where Hevrin Khalaf's car was shot at and she was killed. A farmer who asked us to conceal his identity found her body, along with eight others at the checkpoint.
The first person I saw was the girl. Her body was roughly 5 meters away from the car. Her face was completely disfigured. And her leg was damaged really badly, probably broken.
A medical report showed that she'd been shot 20 times. Akhra al-Shakir told the BBC that fighters were at the checkpoint that day and that they opened fire at a car they claimed didn't stop. They also added that they didn't target Hevrin Khalaf specifically and don't know how she was killed.
Here is another runaway pig who was eliminated by the SNA.
But this is from a video showing their fighters surrounding Hevrin's bullet-ridden car and tells a different story. As a fighter shouts to someone inside the car, we can just make out a faint but composed female voice.
It is Hevrin's voice. I would recognise her out of 5,000 voices.
We played this to Hevrin's mother, Suad Mohammed.
When I heard her voice, I saw the brutality of the world and that there is no humanity in this world.
This confirms Hevrin Khalaf was alive and able to identify herself to the soldiers when her car was stopped. Our evidence suggests she was dragged from the car alive and executed on the road by fighters from the Turkish-backed faction Akhra al-Shakir. In a statement, the faction told us,
"The group that set up the roadblock on the M4 that day did so without permission. Those who violated orders from leadership have been sent for trial. We repeat that we had nothing to do with the killing of Hevrin Khalaf."
The Turkish government, who back the Syrian National Army group, have not responded to BBC requests for comment. The UN Human Rights Commissioner has urged Turkey to launch an investigation into Hevrin Khalaf's death.
"Now, I'm very lonely."
Her mother, Suad Mohammed, believes her daughter's legacy will live on as someone who wanted all ethnicities to work together in Syria.
"After my Hevrin was martyred, some Kurdish women gave birth to girls and named them Hevrin, before even my daughter was buried. I can say now I have more than one Hevrin, and I will have more."
The mother of Hevrin Khalaf, ending that report by the BBC's Simon Cox into who was responsible for her daughter's killing. From today, Tuesday the 14th of January, Microsoft will stop offering support for customers running Windows 7, the operating software first launched back in 2009. Estimates suggest 440 million people could still be running it on their computers. Sasha Twining spoke to Shona Ghosh, Business Insider magazine's UK tech editor, and asked her if it would mean that some computers would just stop working.
If you have a PC that runs Windows 7 and after it sort of reaches its end of life, the operating system, your computer, will still work as normal. What won't happen, though, is that you'll receive the sort of usual fortnightly security updates from Microsoft, and as a result, it makes your laptop or PC more vulnerable to external security risks. And it sort of more impacts businesses than individuals. But for individuals, you know, it's still a worry, especially if you perhaps have parents who may not be quite so tech savvy, you know, may not recognise if a link that they're clicking on in an email is dodgy, for example. So you sort of want them to be as protected as possible. And so it is worth very much considering an upgrade to a different operating system or a more up-to-date Windows operating system like Windows 10.
But exactly what you've just mentioned, that particular group of consumers who may be unaware that this is happening, they don't follow tech stories. I mean, what sort of duty does Microsoft have to them?
I think if anything, Microsoft has previously got into trouble for too aggressively pushing people to upgrade their operating systems and in some cases automatically upgrading them. And that can feel like a whole different computer once that's happened. So the company has to find a balance between sort of forcing people to upgrade and actually asking for informed consent and saying, can we download this update onto your computer? But yeah, I think it's tricky. I don't think there's no perfect way for people to be informed about the risks to their PC, except to, you know, hopefully be listening to the news and sort of reading the news and being told.
Of course, this isn't the first time that Microsoft has done something like this. When Windows XP was decommissioned, there were quite a few issues there. Has the company said anything about anything he may have learnt from that process?
So it's more about individual organisations' responsibility. So what you're referring to there is the massive virus WannaCry, and that affected XP, and it's because so many of certainly British systems and organisations run on XP, particularly the NHS has been heavily reliant on XP. And what I would say in defence of Microsoft is that security experts, IT consultants, Microsoft itself warned for a very long time that XP was going to be decommissioned and there wouldn't be security updates available. And something like the NHS is such a vast organisation, it is very difficult to upgrade all the systems all at once. So there are consultants, Microsoft can help organisations upgrade, but fundamentally, if you're working with something that is as large, as complex, as sprawling as the NHS, you're always going to run into issues.
Shoni, you're mentioning the NHS, the British National Health Service, but this is a whole global issue. Do we have any idea of the numbers or the scale of or the size of the businesses still using Windows 7?
So 25% of all Windows users are still running Windows 7, which is a very large percentage given it's about to hit end of life. You would normally be aiming for something at 10% or under. But part of the issue is that the natural next upgrade, Windows 10, was very unpopular when it first came out in 2015. And that's put many businesses and many consumers off upgrading. You know, they feel comfortable on Windows 7. Windows 10 was highly criticised for some privacy issues and the fact that it sort of forced updates and installations which people weren't particularly comfortable with.
Shona Ghosh from Business Insider magazine. The dark comic book adaptation Joker has received the most nominations for this year's Oscars. Once again, those drawing up the shortlists have been criticised about the lack of diversity. All the nominees for Best Director, for instance, were men. So when I spoke to our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd, I began by asking, where are the women?
Not that many, are there? All right. Little Women, which actually, I being absolutely honest when I say it's a very, very good film. It's one of my favourite films of this bunch of films, is in there as Best Picture. My guess is it won't win Best Picture. What people are very fed up about, and I don't blame them really, is that Greta Gerwig has not been nominated as Best Director. Sometimes people can't discern between Best Picture and Best Director. It feels like it should be the same thing, but it's not. And I think it's a very, very good film. And there is a shocking lack of diversity, to be honest, in this. And if you remember, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, everyone was saying there's a shocking lack of diversity and we're going to do something about it. And a previous boss of AMPAS, the Oscar organisation in the States, began to do something about it. And that impetus has been slightly lost. But it's deeply mysterious because there are 9,500, roughly, members of AMPAS, about 8,500 of them vote, and they vote their own way. And it's kind of secret how they vote. So there has not been as much change in any category as, well, I might have hoped, to be absolutely honest, and as one might have thought.
So looking at the nominations, there are lots of nominations for The Joker, for 1917, for The Irishman,
yep.
And also Hollywood loves films about Hollywood, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's undeniable. So Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Quentin Tarantino film, also has lots and lots of nominations. It's quite a boy-y list of best film nominees. I'm not actually saying that any of them is bad. I mean, my favourite is 1917, which barely has a female face in it, but it's still a very, very good film. You can't judge films entirely on their ethnic balance or their gender balance, but you do feel that underneath there's something here which is not quite right.
And were there any surprises in the nominations? Is there anything that we should be looking out for?
I'm not sure there are many surprises. One or two people thought, for instance, that Taron Egerton would get a nod for playing Elton John. Actually, he's very good in that in Rocketman. But in terms of inclusions, which are utterly surprising, this year I don't think there are.
OK, so you don't think Little Women is going to win Best Picture. Just between you and me, before I go to the bookies, who do you think is going to win?
I think I might have said this before on this programme for the last couple of years. It is quite difficult to say. There is an absolute outrider here in terms of Parasite, which is the South Korean film from Bong Joon-ho, which is a very, very good film. It would be extraordinary if a non-English language film were to win. However, I think it might, and it's got huge support in Hollywood. My own particular favourite is 1917. It would be slightly predictable, I think, if The Irishman won, because that's Scorsese and De Niro and all those people who were great 25 years ago, but they're kind of doing the same thing that they were doing 25 years ago, just looking a bit more creaky about it, as we all are.
Speak for yourself, Vincent. But while we're on the subject, let's talk about the midlife crisis. Not mine, obviously, but that time in our lives when some people question the point of it all. Latest research in the US shows that it is a real thing and that in developed nations, the low point comes at 47 years old. But the cheerful news is that life does seem to get better after that. Professor David Blanchflower from Dartmouth College in New Hampshire in the US carried out the research.
So the first thing is that the data shows that there's a midlife crisis. You can either see it in happiness, which means there's a U-shape, which means there's a trough in happiness. And if you flip the thing upside down and say, well, what about unhappiness? The peak unhappiness is at the end of the 40s around the world. So the answer is that it's there in the data. And the final thing is it's even there in the data for great apes. Maybe there's something deeply biological about it.
Now, that is fascinating, because I was going to ask you why 47.2 is so hard. So it's not necessarily just external factors, family pressures and so on.
In some sense, the crisis appears to be worse for the people who are the most vulnerable. This giant story that's in the United States that's going on about deaths of despair particularly relates to the prime age, particularly prime age whites with less education. So yes, this is a crisis that sort of appears to be present, but some people are more vulnerable than others. And it certainly looks around the world that some people are in communities that are not as resilient as others and don't, in a sense, give them protection from this midlife crisis that looks like it's inevitably coming to people.
Do you have any words of reassurance for exhausted 30-year-olds who really are not thrilled at the notion that it's not going to get better for quite a long time?
Well, I wish you'd ask me, do I have things to say to exhausted 50-year-olds? Because the great thing about exhausted 50-year-olds is that, boy, is it going to get better. And pretty darn quickly, because this happiness function slopes up. And I'm glad to say that I'm a little older than 50, and I'm on this upward sloping part. I mean, for the 30-year-olds, obviously life is tough and people are struggling. Real wages in the UK are lower today than they were 10 years ago. So stick with it. But I think the answer would be look out to other people, realize that other people are in the same situation as you are, and don't bowl alone. Be there and share things with others and go to social things. Be involved with your neighbors and others. Don't bowl alone.
That was Professor David Blanchflower. Now, it's a mystery that has been baffling residents in a village in northeastern England for 5 years. Just who has been leaving bundles of cash around the former mining village of Blackhall Colliery? Over the years, thousands of pounds had turned up on the streets for people to find. Well, it seems that the local police have now got to the bottom of it, as our correspondent Fiona Trott reports.
On a dark, wet and windy evening here at Blackhall Colliery, you can just make out the Pit Wheel Monument, a reminder of the coal industry that defined this area until the 1980s. The streets here were never paved with gold, until recently. For the past few years, bundles of notes, each adding up to £2,000, have been found dumped on the street. Now the donors have finally come forward, but only the police know their true identity. DC John Forster is from Durham Police.
They have a deep personal affection and affinity to Blackhall Colliery and the people. It's an unusual thing to do, but they have left the money out to be found by people who they've almost targeted. So the money's been found by the people they wanted it to be found by. And it sounds like they've left just a few seconds to enjoy the moment and to confirm it's been picked up by the people they wanted it to be picked up by.
People living here say the mystery money has given the community a boost.
People are now realising there's many, many genuine people out there. There's more people definitely coming to Black Hole now, seeing if they can find this money.
That's probably why we've got a lot of people walking about early on the morning with the dogs in there. Not going to work.
A lot of the residents aren't that fortunate, so I think it'll help a lot of people out.
Just in case any outsiders were thinking of descending upon this village, a note of caution. Finding money and keeping it is against the law. At least the people who have reported it to the police now know the donors deliberately left it for them.
That was Fiona Trott in northeastern England. And that's it from us for now. I'm off to search for bundles of cash in the street, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this one or the topics we've covered, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
If you're paying attention to the headlines, you've heard about ransomware, a computer virus that locks your files until you pay a ransom. But did you know that more and more businesses are under attack? The key to stopping ransomware is protecting yourself before you're attacked. With Carbonite, if your business becomes infected, you can recover clean files from their super secure servers. Best of all, you don't have to remember to upload files. Carbonite does it automatically. Try it free at carbonite.com/podcasts and receive 2 free months if you buy.